welcome to the Science Podcast for March 14th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, predator-induced cloning, organic chemistry going on around other stars, a worldwide assessment of agricultural science and technology, and collaborations between academia and companies. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Fight or flight. That's the typical response we think of when faced with danger. But how about cloning yourself? In a paper in this week's Science, Don Vaughn and Richard Strathman at the University of Washington showed that's the response of sand dollar larvae to clone themselves when they are exposed to mucus from predatory fish. The researchers propose that this cloning provides a temporary refuge from the predators because the smaller clones are harder for the fish to detect. I spoke with Vaughn from her home in Indiana.
Prey organisms have evolved numerous ways to defend against predators, and for some of these organisms, the mere presence of predators induces defensive structures or behaviors that are otherwise not present in the absence of predators. So with our study, we found that when sand dollar larvae are exposed to stimuli indicating the presence of predators, so in this case, fish mucus, they clone themselves. And in doing so, the larval sand dollars effectively reduce their size, which may provide a temporary refuge from predation by producing two smaller, less detectable larvae. And this is a rather unique predator-induced response, and it's a dramatic departure from what we would consider normal development.
You said fish mucus, is that right?
Yes, yeah, fish mucus was the inducing stimulus.
So the fish mucus stimulates this cloning. How long does it take for the clones to develop and separate?
Well, from our study, the cloning occurs within 24 hours. Now, it could occur quicker than that, but we checked the larvae and their development 24 hours later after we exposed them to the cue. So within 24 hours, they're responding to the cue by producing embryo-like buds that detach and develop into smaller but normal sand dollar larvae.
So it's not a response to the fish attack, merely to the presence of the fish, as indicated by the presence of fish mucus.
Exactly.
Are these sand dollar larvae found in the wild not in the presence of fish?
I doubt they would be found in the water without the presence of fish, because as larvae, they spend a period of their development in the open water, growing and developing to a point of metamorphic competence. And at that point, they settle to the benthos. So they're out floating in the water amongst all sorts of predators, and fish are definitely a likely predator. And also through some observations that we made in the lab, certain fish definitely eat these larvae.
So it's likely this kind of cloning is going on in the wild all the time.
It is very likely, and in fact, other researchers have done plankton toes, and in those toes have had, in some cases, upwards of 90% of the, I believe these were sea star larvae, that they brought into the laboratory were in the process of cloning.
Why do you suppose this cloning happens at the vulnerable larva stage rather than by the sand dollar sensing these predators and reducing egg size or something like that?
Well, that's a great question, and we would hypothesize that there's a number of reasons why. One, developmentally, they're capable of cloning, and cloning has been documented previously, but identifiable cues for cloning have been limited to things that are conducive to growth and reproduction, so namely food, abundant food, and favorable temperatures. So cloning is possible, but why we really think this happens is that the parent sand dollars, the mother, can't assess risk to her planktonic larvae. She's on the seafloor. She has no idea what types of risks her offspring are going to meet in their planktonic environment. So the larvae respond to cues from predators, and they're capable of responding by reducing their size rather than have the parent reduce the egg size. I mean, there's a possibility that they won't run into any fish, but if they do, then the larvae are capable of responding by changing their size through cloning.
Now, a lot of ocean organisms or sea organisms respond to increased amounts of predators or predators by having lots and lots and lots of eggs.
Yes, that's definitely one way of doing it, in hope that a few of them make it back to the shore.
Is this an alternative approach of just producing a few number of eggs and then having those eggs clone themselves essentially as larvae?
I suppose that could be one way to do it, although echinoderms typically, the ones in which fertilization takes place in the water column and their offspring are going through a period of a few weeks developing, they produce tons and tons of eggs and tons of sperm. So this is one potential way to increase the likelihood that you have recruitment of juveniles into the adult habitat.
Well, Dawn Vaughn, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I really, really appreciate your call.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye. Dawn Vaughn is lead author of a paper on how predators induce cloning in sand dollar larvae. Read the paper in this week's Science.
Also this week in Science, hiding from bloodthirsty insects. In a paper published online, Matthias Dietzen and colleagues have identified how the insect repellent DEET works to mask our smell from mosquitoes and other blood-sucking insects. By recording neural activity and behavioral observations in insects, the researchers found that DEET blocks odor receptors that require a specific olfactory protein that the insects need to smell us. The research could lead to safer and more effective insect repellents against blood-feeding insects, which are responsible for transmitting many of the world's deadliest diseases. Read the paper at www.scienceexpress.org. Newly formed stars are typically surrounded by flattened, rotating disks of gas and small dust particles, and these disks are believed to provide the raw material for making planets. In a paper in this week's Science, John Carr and colleagues report new observations that reveal that these disks also contain abundant amounts of water and other simple organic molecules, suggesting that there's some organic chemistry going on as well. I spoke with Carr from his office at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C.
Now, in our study, we looked in great detail at the infrared light emitted by a planet-forming disk around one young star. We used the infrared spectrograph on NASA's Fisher Space Telescope, which enabled us to measure the chemical signatures of a number of molecules within the disk and to determine the chemical makeup of the gas there. And what we were able to detect within the disk was the presence of simple organic molecules and water vapor. And many other things make these very interesting. First of all, some of these molecules we detect are the basic precursors to forming more complex chemical building blocks of life. And not only were we able to detect these molecules in the disk, but we found they're present in very large amounts. In fact, the molecules are more abundant inside of the disk than they are in the interstellar gas that's found in interstellar space. Now, that's the raw material that forms new stars and their planet-forming disks. So this suggests that there's an active chemistry that takes place within the disk, which is forming new molecules, enhances them over their original abundances.
Have these kinds of measurements been made before?
There have been at least one measurement before of organic molecules within a disk. That, too, was done by the Fisher Space Telescope. But in that case, the detection there relied upon a very special circumstance of the disk being oriented in just exactly the right way in order to detect the molecules. The difference of what we've done here is the method we've used has a more general application that would allow us astronomers to measure chemical composition and organic molecules in water in large number of star disk systems in the galaxy.
Is there anything else that would result in a similar emission spectrum other than the presence of these simple organic molecules?
No, because each molecule has its own particular spectral signature, which is quite unique from others. So the spectrograph provides us enough spectral dispersion to determine uniquely that the molecules we detect are indeed what they are.
So with this new method, is it likely that similar organic molecules will be observed around other similar stars?
Definitely. The star we observed is actually a very typical young solar mass star with a planet-forming disk. There's nothing special about the star we have reported on in the paper. So we anticipate in the next couple of years we'll be seeing a large number of similar results coming out based on data coming from the Spitzer Space Telescope and in dozens of stars. So we should look forward to that.
What are the implications of the presence of these simple organic molecules? Let's see, there's carbon dioxide, hydrogen cyanide, acetylene, water vapor, and hydroxide.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, some of these are very important precursors for forming more complex molecules. For example, we detect a large amount of hydrogen cyanide. Hydrogen cyanide is one precursor to some pathways for forming amino acids, for example. Now, it's true we're only measuring some of the most simple organic molecules at this time, but the large amounts of these simple molecules suggest the real possibility that more complex molecules of interest more directly to astrobiology, ones that we can't currently directly measure, they can indeed be formed within the disk.
So will other scientists be able to use these results or methods to narrow their search for Earth-like planets? Or is this more where such planets might form many millions of years from now?
These results on measuring the gas within the planet-forming disk have no direct implication on the detection or measurement of Earth-like planets. However, the region of the disk we are probing right now corresponds to a distance from the star where, in our solar system, we find Earth-like planets and where planets of various masses are found around other stars. So we're understanding now what the composition of the material is at these distances that will eventually form Earth-like planets.
So these will help model makers as well, those who are trying to figure out how Earth-like planets did form.
This will definitely help model makers, also in general how planets form, and in terms of our solar system. In our solar system, we can make rather detailed measurements. For example, we could, in a laboratory, analyze the composition of meteorites that land on the Earth or measure remotely the composition of comets. These all tell us something about what was happening in the solar system at the time of its birth. Now we'll be able to make similar type of measurements of chemical composition around other planet-forming disks, and we can make these comparisons to what we know about our own solar system.
John Carr, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Carr is lead author of a paper on organic molecules and water in the planet formation region of circumstellar disks. Read the paper, as well as a related perspective, in this week's Science. The population of the world is expected to swell to about 9 billion people this century, and feeding all of us will present some challenges, especially to people living in developing nations. To try to plan ahead for these challenges, the World Bank initiated an open partnership to create the International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development. Now, that partnership is about to release its report, a report that is more than 3 years in the making, and a few partners have dropped out. Science News writer Eric Stockstedt writes about it in this week's issue.
It's really the largest assessment of agricultural research that's ever been done. More people came together to ask basic questions about how agricultural research and knowledge and technology are going to be able to help solve some really big, big challenges that we're going to face in the 21st century. For example, we're going to have 3 more billion people by the end of the century, going from 6 billion to 9 billion. Where's the food going to come from? As people eat more and more meat, where's the grain going to come to feed the cows? What's that going to mean for all of the ecosystems that are being turned into farms? How much pollution is that going to generate? What is the fate of the small farmer in Africa going to be? Is there any way that he or she is going to be able to compete with large agricultural companies? What about issues of social equity, poverty? How do we bring all of these poor farmers out, lift them out of poverty? Can agricultural research and science help do that? What's the best way to proceed? Not to mention biofuels, which we already see them raising food prices. So as more and more fields are growing crops destined to become fuel, where's the food come from?
So what was the goal then? I mean, there's a lot of questions there. What was the goal of this International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development?
The goal of the group was to answer one overarching question, and here it is. It's from the website. How can we reduce hunger and poverty, improve rural livelihoods, and facilitate equitable, environmentally, social, and economically sustainable development through the generation, access to, and use of agricultural knowledge, science, and technology?
Now, just in the way you said that, suggests that this is a pretty big goal. Have other groups taken on such enormous questions before?
Not in agriculture. This is really the broadest one. Other people have looked at parts of it, but they're really trying to do the whole noodle here. There have been other groups that have tried to answer big questions. You think of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which was trying to figure out what's the state of the world's ecosystems. And this isn't the first collection of international scientists to come together and answer a question. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, pulled together hundreds of scientists to ask a specific question about what the impact of climate change is, for example.
And that was pretty successful, wasn't it?
That had a lot of policy impact, absolutely. So it was a good sign that the person who got this agricultural assessment moving out of the gate was Bob Watson. He was the first chair of the IPCC, so things were off to a good start.
Who else was involved in this assessment for the agriculture?
The idea was to pull together all the stakeholders, not only the people who create agricultural research, who do the research, but representatives of people who use it, so the farmers, to look at social scientists who study rural communities. Agriculture is such a big thing. Food touches on so many things. So they wanted to bring in as many of the people who work on agriculture, who are impacted by agriculture, all together.
And when did this start and what happened?
It took a good year or two of planning to frame the questions, and then 400 scientists started to meet to really assess the data, analyze it. That was finishing up probably by 2007. They were writing these reports, and it was a long process. What people tell me is at times it actually got fairly heated when people had different views about what agricultural research should be doing, what the data were saying.
Why was it heated?
And there are probably several reasons. One of them was that, honestly, different groups were coming from very different viewpoints. You had Greenpeace, which has a policy that they don't want to see genetically modified crops used at all. And you had companies who are in the business of selling and producing more genetically modified crops. So obviously, they weren't going to agree. But more fundamentally, I think there were different views about what agricultural research should be doing, what agriculture should look like. There's a view predominant in Europe that agriculture should have several functions. This isn't just about growing food. It's about rural livelihoods. It's about sustaining communities, maintaining sort of an agricultural landscape. And you can contrast that with what Canada and the middle of the United States look like, and that's about dedicating land to producing food, producing it efficiently, producing it cheaply, and using genetically modified crops to do that. So given that they were starting from such different places, it probably wasn't a surprise that last fall the company said, we really can't participate in this, because they felt like their views weren't coming across in the report. So they pulled out.
So where are we now? Where does that leave the report?
Right now, the process is gearing up for the final meeting, which is going to be in April. That's going to involve representatives from dozens of governments coming together, looking at the report and deciding, can they endorse it or not? The leaders of the assessment, they're disappointed that the companies aren't there anymore. They say it's really not going to have a big impact on the final report, but if this was designed to get everyone together at the table and really try to come up with a consensus, then, it's hard to say that that's not a loss.
So what's next after April and the report comes out?
I think the larger question with any kind of massive report like this is, who reads it and will it change their minds? There are skeptics who look at this report and say, it's really not going to be helpful. It's not providing useful advice because it's not analytical enough. There's just not enough technical detail and specifics about what to do. The proponents of the report say the real advance here is that it's putting small farmers front and center. And the message is, we need to do things to help them. And agricultural research and science and technology and knowledge, that's a way to advance rural farmers, protect the environment, and grow more food. Those are all good things. The question is, how do you do it?
Eric Stockstead, thank you very much.
Rob, my pleasure.
Science News writer Eric Stockstead talking about the International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development, which comes out this April. You can read his article on the assessment in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, how a honeybee becomes queen. In a paper published online, Robert Kucharski and colleagues show the molecular biology behind how eating royal jelly turns a honeybee into a queen. Both fertile queens and sterile female workers start out as genetically identical larvae, but the researchers found that by silencing the expression of DNA methyltransferase, DNMT3, in these larvae, the majority of them developed into queens with fully developed ovaries. The results suggest that the nutrition provided by the royal jelly drives a kind of epigenetic global reprogramming of honeybee development and may lead to new insights into nutrition, longevity, and even drug treatment. Read the paper at www.scienceexpress.org.
Industry funding in an academic setting has some distinct advantages.
Contributing editor Kate Travis talks about this week's Science Careers feature on industry investments in academic research.
To Javier Serra, that funding is music to his ears, literally. Serra is head of the Music Technology Group at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. And what you're listening to is part of a project he's working on with Yamaha to improve on the synthesized violin.
This particular one is taking a new approach in which we not only deal with the sound itself, but we deal with the gesture and we deal with what the performer does. So we are able to handle expressive issues and not just the standard sound issues of the instrument.
Industry funds between 20 and 30% of Serra's research in music technology. It's an arrangement he says works well for his particular field.
I like the model of 30% industry, 30% our university funding and local stable funding, or funding from some programs that can give you stability, and then 30% from European or sort of public projects that are normally a few years long. So we need to have a very stable funding to handle some of this forward thinking. Even to be able to handle Yamaha, we need to invest on some basic research so we can come up and show them some future ideas. And at the same time, we need to have Yamaha in order to make believe the European projects or the local funding that our work has an impact on the industry and on society.
But money from companies usually comes with strings attached.
They expect that they will get results in a short-term period, because in their majority of the cases, they have a specific problem that they need to be solved.
Michael Amiridis is professor and dean of the College of Engineering and Computing at the University of South Carolina. He says 60 to 70% of funding for his research in heterogeneous catalysis comes from industry sources.
Where I see a difference between industrial research and the government-funded research is that they keep a much closer eye on the work that is going on. I'm used to, with our industrial partners, to have a meeting with them, face-to-face meeting, every 3 to 6 months. When I get government funding, I have to file a report at the end of the year, and I meet the program manager at some of the national meetings, but I don't get the close relationship, the close collaboration that I get with the industrial sources.
And one of the biggest areas of concern with such collaborations is in the publication.
We have to negotiate with the industry. Usually they want a period, a waiting period, to be able to review the manuscript that we're about to publish, if there is intellectual property, to go through the filing process and then release it outside. With government funding, there's nothing like this involved. So from my perspective, I need to look at any potential publication restrictions, which are not acceptable, especially for a young faculty member.
But Anthony Boconfuso says that companies are sympathetic to the academics' need to publish. Boconfuso is the executive director of the University Industry Demonstration Partnership, an organization formed to help streamline academic industry partnerships.
I think the issue on publication restrictions is sometimes oversold. Most companies recognize that research that they support at some point has to get into the public domain. What companies obviously want is to ensure that they have an opportunity to protect any ideas that may be generated. So I'm not saying it's free and unfettered publication rights, but companies who support academic research know that academic researchers must be able to publish at some point.
Formalizing industry-academia collaborations does take work, with attorneys, accountants, patent issues, contracts, and publishing rights. Again, from the University of South Carolina, Emeritus says it's well worth it.
Number one, you end up working on some very important problems. In many cases, industry has ownership of a problem that we don't have in academia. So by partnering with them and working on the problem, you end up learning a lot about it, and eventually you gain ownership of your problem yourself.
And students can benefit from working in a lab with industry funding.
Many of my doctoral students that they have graduated from my group are now working for companies that in the past sponsored the work that we were doing here. So it's a great benefit for them. I think that the right balance between industrial funding and government funding actually serves an academic's career very well, especially for somebody who is on the engineering side, as I am. You know, engineers are supposed to be solving important current problems.
Another advantage is that you've got a foot in the door with an industrial partner and a way to commercialize your research.
If you get hooked with industry, funding becomes much easier than it is when you go through the process for the government funding. If they are satisfied, they keep coming back to you.
And that is the sweet sound of success. For Science Careers, this is Kate Travis.
You can read more about industry funding of academic research in this week's Science and online at sciencecareers.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how boys and girls process language differently. We're going to delve a bit further into the mystery of the Indonesian hobbits. And finally, I'll tell you how you can keep a wasp from cheating.
Sounds like a great lineup. Let's start then with how boys and girls process language differently.
Well, this story has to do with the fact that girls tend to score higher than boys on language tests, particularly tests involving verbal fluency and word memory. And researchers wondered, is there something different about the way that boys and girls' brains process language? So to find out, they took about 50 kids aged from 9 to 15, half boys and half girls, and they had them look at words that were either flashed in front of them on a screen or spoken. And the kids had to do things like tell the researchers whether the words rhymed or sounded the same, things like that.
And to look at the brain differences?
Right. And to look at the brain differences, the researchers had the kids hooked up to fMRI, which is a technique that measures blood flow to various parts of the brain. And so the researchers were able to tell what brain regions were more or less activated in boys and girls while they were doing this language test.
So there were different parts that were lighting up?
Right. What they found was in the girls, regardless of whether the words that they were dealing with were spoken or flashed on the screen, the language part of their brain was very active. But in the boys, it depended on whether the words were spoken or shown. If the words were spoken, the auditory parts of their brain were more active. And if the words were flashed in front of them, the visual parts of their brains were more active.
So girls are always thinking language, whether they see it or hear it.
Right. Versus boys, who really aren't using their language region as much as they're using their audio and visual regions of their brain.
Does this have implications for educators?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And the researchers say this, in fact, might provide support for the idea that girls and boys should be taught differently and perhaps even separated into different groups in the classroom because they may actually learn language differently.
Well, how about when boys and girls grow up? Do these same differences in the brain occur in adults too?
Well, they're not sure. And in fact, it may be that boys' brains just don't mature as fast as girls, and that when boys grow older, they are using the language parts of their brains more than the audio or visual parts of their brains when dealing with words. So more research needed.
And not all brains work the same way.
Exactly. If anything else, the study shows that not all brains work the same way.
Well, from the differences in boys and girls' brains to hobbits, which were shown to have a smaller brain size than us, what's new there?
Right, Rob. Well, this story has to do with, as you said, the hobbits. And these are a group of very small people whose bones were found a few years ago in the Indonesian island of Flores. Initially, researchers claimed this was a completely new species of humans. These quote-unquote hobbits had very unique features. They were very small. They only were about 1 meter tall. And as you said, they had very small brains. In fact, brains in many cases smaller than chimpanzee brains. But since then, other researchers have argued, no, these are just regular humans with particular diseases or genetic abnormalities. And this is a debate that's been raging on. Now, there's a new study.
With new fossils?
With new fossils from another island that's probably going to only further inflame the debate. And this study has to do with another group of bones of small people. But this time, the bones have been found in the Micronesian nation of Palau, on one of the Palau Islands. And a researcher who was actually on vacation on this island was shown a cave, and what immediately stood out to him was a very small skull. And he came back with a team of researchers. They did some excavations, and they concluded that these bones were probably about 1,400 to 3,000 years old, and they had many of the same characteristics of the Indonesian hobbits.
Which were how old?
The hobbits themselves are thought to be anywhere from about 12,000 to 95,000 years old, so significantly older than these new small people that have been found in Palau. But this new team is not claiming that these small people are a new species of humans. What they're saying is they're humans that just got very small due to a process called island dwarfing.
Now, what's that?
This is something that's been seen in animals that live on islands that tend to get smaller as time goes on because of the limited resources found on islands. So this team's hypothesis is that this was a group of, at one point, normal-sized humans who somehow got to this island, but over time developed to become smaller and smaller and smaller.
What are other researchers saying about this hypothesis?
Well, some researchers say this just further goes to show that the hobbits from Indonesia really aren't a new species of humans, that they're probably similar to these guys, that they were regular humans at one point that just got smaller due to island dwarfing. But the debate, as I said earlier, rages on. And that's because one researcher, for example, who also does work on this island, says he's found bones of normal-sized people on the island that are about the same age. So he says island dwarfing doesn't make sense because you wouldn't have normal humans and small humans on the same island at the same time if island dwarfing was actually happening. And as far as the researchers that are actually working on the hobbits, they're not buying this idea that these new humans from Palau are anything like the hobbits they're studying. They're saying that the characteristics aren't the same, especially the brain size. They say the brain size of the hobbits that they're studying is much smaller than these people from Palau. So they're saying that this new study has nothing to do with them and is not going to change how they feel about the Indonesian hobbits being a new species of human.
Okay, well, from the evolution of potentially small people to the evolution of a cooperative relationship between figs and wasps. What's happening in this story?
This story, Rob, is about wasps that could cheat but don't.
Now, what do you mean by cheat?
Well, in order to tell you what I mean by cheating, we've got to back up for a second. And fig trees and wasps have a very codependent relationship. Fig trees, as you know, produce figs. And these figs are full of tiny flowers and seeds on the inside. And they also have little holes in them, which insects known as fig wasps can get in. And when these wasps go into the fig, they lay their eggs in ovules within the fig. And these ovules are parts of the flowers that would normally develop into seeds. But when the wasps lay their eggs, the seeds don't develop, and instead the wasp larvae hatch and feed off the inside of the fig. And that's good news for the wasp.
How's it good for the fig tree?
It's good for the fig tree because once these wasps grow up and fly out of the fig, they carry pollen with them from the tree and take it to other places. So this relationship is good for the wasp and good for the fig trees.
But the wasp would cheat by taking over too many of the figs. Is that it?
Well, they would cheat by taking over too many of these ovules. In other words, there's a ton of ovules available to them once they enter the fig. And so theoretically, if they took up all the ovules, they would get tons of offspring, but the fig tree would lose out because none of its seeds would form. But the wasps don't do this. They only take some of the ovules.
Why does that happen?
Well, that's the question. Why aren't these wasps cheating when they could? And the answer comes from another group of wasps called parasitic wasps. And these guys seem like bad guys from the outside. And what they do is they also use the figs as a nursery. But they don't fly through the little holes that the fig wasps fly through. Instead, they poke through just the top of the fig and lay eggs in ovules that are already occupied by fig wasps. So in other words, they're only targeting seeds that have only been utilized by fig wasps.
So if the fig wasps lay their eggs in ovules near the edge of the fig, then the parasitic wasps can kill them.
Right.
So these parasitic wasps are essentially selecting for fig wasps that only lay their eggs on the inside of the fig.
Exactly. The overall idea, basically, is that it behooves fig wasps to only lay their eggs on the inside. And the reason they're doing this is because they don't want their larvae killed by the other wasps. That turns out to be good news for the fig tree because it gets the pollination from the fig wasps. And at the same time, a lot of its ovules are untouched, which will eventually turn into seeds.
What's the time scale here? How long has this been going on?
This is a relationship that's been around for about 60 million years. And thanks to the parasitic wasps keeping the fig wasps honest, it's a relationship that's likely to persist for millions of more years.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about Jurassic turtles, how the sun contributes or doesn't contribute to global warming, and finally, what causes green urine. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check up on the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the March 14th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.